own birth certificate, and his and Rachel's marriage certificate. No death certificate, just a pile of letters addressed to HM Prison, Dartmoor. She opened one and realized that they were the letters her mother had sent to him in prison. She opened more, scanning the handwriting and seeing that some were from her gran, too. Only one envelope stood out from the others. It was stiff and large, addressed to their house, so more recent than the rest. It was from a London solicitor, from Rachel's solicitor, warning Charlie not to contact or visit, or they would have no alternative but to apply for an injunction against him. "My client has no wish for further contact with you," she read. The letter was dated 15 years ago when Amy had been 5. Rachel had been alive and hadn't wanted to see them. Hadn't wanted to know her own daughter. The woman had gone so far as to threaten legal action if Charlie even tried. If Amy's mood had been angry before, this discovery only served to fuel the flames. Now she was incandescent. Her mother was alive, and it looked like she was a complete bitch. What kind of woman walked away from her own child? Anger gave way to a swathe of hurt that sighed through her and nearly took her off her feet. Mind-reeling, she tried to absorb what it all meant, what it said about her, Amy, the child her mother didn't want. The sensation of abject sorrow was too much to bear, and she had to shut the feeling away and cling onto the anger. Not that she knew who it was for yet. The mother she'd believed was dead, her father for the lie, or her gran. But you didn't get angry with gran. Life wasn't worth living if you got on her wrong side. As much as she was loving and kind, she could turn. And when she turned nasty. No, gran wasn't the one she could run to, not about this. Not about anything that challenged her cozy world. Now that she had locked the emotions down, she could be rational and work out what she needed to do, because she had to do something. Rachel's address was etched into her mind. It was simple. She would go there and confront the woman who had faked her own death to abandon her family. Amy wanted to know why, and she wanted to know now. Back in the house, it took only moments to look up train times and find that if she was quick, she could be on a train in 45 minutes and in London an hour and a half after that. She took the letters and stuffed them in her backpack. She also took her father's secret stash of cash, £500, rolled up and secured with an elastic band and kept hidden in a piece of spare wastepipe in the back of the sink unit cupboard. He thought she didn't know about this, but she had watched him many a time unscrew the dummy pipe and store his money. He owed her for all this, so she wasn't going to feel bad about taking it. As she headed across the sitting room towards the door, she looked towards the mantelpiece and saw the photograph of her father holding her. She had been about 4 and was sitting on his shoulders, and they were both grinning at the camera. It was a mutual favourite picture, and she couldn't remember a time when it hadn't been on display somewhere in the house. The sight of it stirred the feeling she was trying so hard to suppress. She picked up the picture and hurled it against the wall, wincing as the image shattered, littering the floor with tiny shards of glass. She was sick of it. It wasn't real. None of it had been real. Not this house, not her dad, not this life. For good measure, she followed the picture with the plate of cold pizza, watching in satisfaction as it slid slowly down the wall, leaving a trail of cold, congealed gunk in its wake. Satisfied, she stalked from the house, slamming the front door so hard that the glass pane at the top cracked from the impact. Chapter 10. For a moment or two, Rachel thought that Charlie might hit her. She would have let him. It would be well deserved. He was breathing hard, gritting his jaw and biting down against all the things he so obviously wanted to say. He was clenching his fists, and it looked to Rachel as if he was barely stopping himself from tearing the place apart and leaving her life in as many tatters as she'd once left his. She watched him, warily, fighting the urge to shift away from him and run for the door. "Tell me about Amy. What's she like? And I know I don't deserve to know." The desire to know something of her child fought gamely with her fear of his anger, and she hoped that thoughts of Amy would divert his brewing rage. He sighed, the tension rapidly ebbing away, leaving him deflated, exhausted, done. Shaking his head as if to fling off the last shreds of his temper, he said, "She's like you to look at." Rachel was disappointed at this. She didn't want her daughter to be anything like her. She wanted to hear that Amy was brave, intelligent, capable, and full of life. "Does she have friends? Is she happy?" "She's happy enough. She's at college, training to be a nurse. There are plenty of friends, no boyfriends, or at least none that I know of. Not that she would tell me. She's a good kid." You always were good at scaring off unwanted boyfriends, she said, a sad smile turning up the corners of her mouth. He jammed his hands in his pockets and gritted his teeth again. Let's not attempt small talk, eh? She saw that he knew exactly what she was talking about. With a look telling her that he was in no mood for gentle reminiscing, he walked away from her, out into the hallway and into the sitting room. Lila's presence in the flat was stronger than Rachel's, even though Lila had been dead for 20 years. Rachel watched him come under the spell as he touched the spines of her books, peered at photographs, and breathed in the scent of the undead past. He still wore his wedding ring. She hadn't kept hers. She'd left it behind on Delia's kitchen table the day she'd left. It was a bid to help him to hate her, help him move on, have a life. Nevertheless, here he was, waiting for her to tell him the truth. It wasn't going to happen. The truth was a story no one should ever have to know. But she owed him something, and she needed him to leave and never come back. After I had Amy, the fits got worse. You know that. I was scared I would hurt her, drop her, harm her, I don't know, but I couldn't cope. I thought she would be better off without me. You both would. I was a liability, she said, unable to look at his face. Charlie didn't say anything for a moment, just looked at her, standing in her mausoleum of a flat, looking like some gawky kid and expecting him to believe everything she said. She ought to have known him better than that, but she'd had to try. He shook his head and gave a wry laugh. Bullshit. Rachel was floundering. She needed him to leave. Look, you only married me because I was pregnant with Amy, then you realized you couldn't even leave me on my own with her. What kind of life is that for any of us? I was grateful you took me on, but I grew up and realized it was never going to work. That's it. It's all there is to say. You should thank me. I did us all a favor. Charlie's jaw fell in disbelief. Christ. You're just like the rest of them. What is this, the Porter curse or something? He shouted, throwing his hands into the air. She flinched away from him, which only served to make him even angrier. He strode towards the door. Do us both a real favor, Rachel. Don't come back, not ever. Okay. Rachel winced as the door slammed. One of Lila's bone china plates wobbled and fell off the dresser, smashing irretrievably on the kitchen floor. When she was sure Charlie wasn't coming back, she bent to pick up the pieces, struggling to breathe as the knot of pain in her chest started to unravel, releasing 19 years of grief and anguish as it unfurled. The pain of it made her gasp. She grasped one of the slivers of broken china, squeezing it hard, hoping that the sharp, cutting sensation would cancel out the choking emotional agony. White light shot through her brain as the pain hit, shorting out the capacity for further thought as an almighty seizure took hold and brought her down. Charlie gunned the van, screeching away from the building like a man possessed, and frightening the living crap out of a gang of drunks who were serenading the neighborhood on their way home. He didn't care if the police pulled him over. He didn't care if he lost control and went crashing into the nearest lamppost. All he knew at that moment was that Rachel was right. She had done them all a favor. His temper was still white hot when he reached the M4. Amy's train had come to a complete standstill, literally grinding to a halt in what appeared to be the middle of nowhere. All she could see when she tried to peer out of the window was her own face staring back at her, the glass a mirror in the pitch-black night. The carriage was almost empty, just a few passengers staring at each other and shrugging with confusion at the delay. Amy had 2 seats to herself and was glad she wasn't opposite anyone who might want to engage her in conversation. Just in case, she stared at the floor in a deliberate attempt to avoid potential eye contact. Had the station shop been open, she would have bought a magazine and hidden behind that. But everything had been closed when she got there. Even her ticket had come out of a machine. Hers was the last train, so not even a buffet car. She was stuck. Then she remembered the letters. Fate had presented her with an opportunity to look through them before she got to London. Knowledge was power, and if she intended to confront her mother, a little power wouldn't go amiss. She rummaged in her bag for the bundle of letters just as an announcement came over the speakers, telling them all that there was a delay up ahead and that the train would be moving again as soon as they could resolve the problem. She opened the first letter to the chorus of grumblings and sighs from her fellow passengers. To her disappointment, the letter was from her gran, but its contents were quite interesting. Rachel comes to see me most days, calls in after school. I can't say I blame her not wanting to go home to those nutcases, although she seems a bit brighter now Roy has gone. I still can't get over that, him just up and leaving like he did. I thought he would hang in there until the bitter end. Still, given what he was up to with poor Patsy, I can't say I'm sorry he's gone, even though it should be him behind bars and not you. Anyway, little Rachel sends her love, poor kid. The rest of the letter was of no interest to Amy. Just her gran wittering on about the price of meat and what colour she was going to paint the lounge. Some things never changed. The date was interesting, though. 14th of April, 1978. She pulled out the marriage certificate and checked Rachel's date of birth. When the letter was written, her mother would have been 11 years old. Until this point, Amy hadn't known that her mother was one of the Porter family. She hadn't connected the dots and hadn't realized that Rachel had been entangled with what had happened to Charlie. How stupid she'd been. Never asking any questions, just blithely going through life thinking that everything was just tragic and lovely, and that everyone in it was fundamentally okay. All this time, and she'd not even been curious. What the hell was that about? Was she an idiot? She tore open the next letter, this time dated 1979, and scanned the page looking for a mention of Rachel in the mundane ramblings of her grand scrawl. Rachel still visits. She's growing up fast, and I don't suppose you would even recognize her now. Still, she sends her love, always asks after you. And so they went on, letter after letter, marking the years of her father's incarceration with nothing more than a few flimsy pages. Rachel was made to sound wonderful, a girl who blossomed over the years, who was sweet, charming, and kind. This Rachel did not sound like the type of person who would abandon her child. Wonderful, lovely Rachel growing up delightful, despite her monster family. Then the last letter, when Rachel was 18. I can't tell you how upset I am. Rachel came today. It had been raining, came down in bloody buckets, so by the time she got here, she was soaked to her skin. Well, I don't think I've ever seen anyone that wet, so, like you do, I got her to strip off her wet things. Well, I probably shouldn't tell you this, but I'm that upset I have to tell someone. Anyway, I made her take her blouse off, and you never seen anything like it. That bloody bitch of a woman has been beating her with a belt. That poor kid has scars all over her back. You can see the buckle marks where the skin is broken. I couldn't believe it. I knew Valerie Porter was a bitter woman, but I never thought she would do that to a kid. I tell you, it was all I could do to stop myself going round there and taking the belt to the old bitch myself. Amy stopped reading, her head full of the picture that her gran had described. Then she turned the page, only to find that the prison censor had blocked the words out in a heavy black ink. The whole page had obviously been screwed up at some point and then smoothed back out. She guessed that was her father's doing. He must have read it and lost his cool, being stuck in a cell where he could do nothing about it. There were no more letters because in 10 years he'd only kept those that mentioned Rachel. Amy didn't want to dwell on it. Something about a grown man, her own father, being that fascinated by a kid bothered her. She stuffed the letters back in her bag and stared back at the window, trying to look beyond her own frowning face. If she did the maths, her dad was 15 years older than Rachel. That would be like her going out with Chris Hemsworth or Sam Worthington. It didn't seem quite so perverse when she thought about it like that. Plenty of girls went out with older blokes. One of the girls in college was knocking off a lecturer, and if looks were anything to go by, her dad had a good 10 years on him. Still, she wasn't related to them. What did it matter anyway? It wasn't the reason Rachel had abandoned her, and it wasn't the reason her gran and Charlie had lied to her. The only thing that was clear was that her gran had loved Rachel, and so had her dad. So God knows what had gone so wrong that they would rather pretend she was dead. As soon as the damn train got moving, she would be closer to finding out what it was, straight from the horse's mouth. Chapter 11. Mary Hammond sat down, sighed heavily, and kicked off her shoes under the desk. If time were on her side, she'd get a glance at the morning paper before the day shift got in. Although she would be lucky. The patients had been buzzing all night. God knows what got into them all sometimes. One would start, then the rest had to get on the bandwagon too. When she'd taken the job as night sister on the unit, she'd hoped it would be an easy ride, but this lot were like night owls, perking up as soon as the sun went down. Lunatic was the right word, all lively when the moon was out. She had only just managed to get Bill Smith back in his bed, and to manage that she'd had to ply him with Ovaltine and force a couple of sleeping tablets down his neck. Something was upsetting him. Usually he was the least of her worries on nights, but referring to his notes, she saw that he hadn't been much better during the day lately either. What with that and the students kicking off at each other, things weren't particularly rosy in the workplace. That was one thing about regular nights. No snot-nosed students to deal with. She'd met the lad Nick, who was a bit of an arsehole in her opinion. Thought he was God's gift to nursing and had all the answers, she thought with a smug smile on her face. Give him a couple of years and he'd know the score. There were no cures in this game. She'd met kids like him before. Secretly, they'd wanted to be doctors but hadn't made the grade or didn't have the stamina. So they'd try their hands at nursing, throw their weight about and call the shots. Mary had a good cure for uppity students. She'd send them around the wall with a trolley full of enemas, then send them back half an hour later with the bedpans to deal with the fallout. That usually shut them up. It gave a whole new meaning to a shit day at work, she thought with a chuckle. The girl student, Amy, was all right. Worked hard and she was willing to learn. What a shame that she was the one sent home. No one would have missed the cocky boy. Christ, her back was aching. If she'd changed one wet bed that night, she'd changed a dozen. What with that and Bill wandering up and down all night babbling rubbish, she'd just about had enough. Stroll on home time. Still, she had better write up the case notes while she had the chance. It didn't look like she was going to get to the paper after all. The trouble with trying to get your brain to work at 5 in the morning was that it always wanted to wander off and think about things that weren't relevant to what you were trying to do. Despite the fact that he was now securely in his bed, Bill Smith kept on walking into her head. She could remember the first time she'd ever met him on the day he'd arrived at the unit. He had been a street drinker, living for years in doorways and derelict hovels. He had stunk to high heaven and was as mad as a box of frogs. The official diagnosis was of Wernicke-Korsakoff syndrome, but the thing that had always puzzled everyone was his voice. Regardless of the content of his bizarre ramblings, his voice had the cultured lilt of an educated man. It jarred on Mary's worldview that an educated person should end up on the streets. She was of the liberal persuasion that a good education cured all social ills. The police had brought him in. He was sectioned because he posed a risk to both himself and others, having acquired the habit of launching himself in front of oncoming cars and occasionally harassing young women, believing them to be his relatives. It was Mary's impression that the police had been hoping that one of the cars would have finished him off and solved their problem, but fate had not chosen to dispose of Bill so neatly. So the NHS was stuck with him. The man with no past and certainly no future. A mystery. So much so that they weren't even sure that Bill Smith was an accurate name. The William bit was right. He'd responded to that, but the Smith part had been adopted by the police as a convenient way of filling in all the boxes on the paperwork. Bill had been with them for 5 years now. The scourge of the unit. Constantly disturbed by thoughts he couldn't articulate. Constantly offensive to those who tried to care for him. Sometimes, Mary thought, we keep people alive for far too long. With a long sigh, she completed the last of the entries in the notes, writing that her patients had slept well, had their bowels open plus plus plus, had a disturbed night, PRN meds had been administered, and so on. It was all so unerringly routine, she wondered why she bothered. She might as well have had a rubber stamp made for all the originality in her nightly entries. All was quiet in the unit, so she finally took a look at last night's late edition of the paper. She was curious to see if there was anything more about the murders that had caught everyone's attention. Always fascinated by the macabre, she scanned the pages looking for something new. Given that the most gruesome thing she ever got to see these days was the aftermath of a dose of laxatives, she figured she could be forgiven for taking an indecorous interest in murder cases. The newspaper was critical, reporting a lack of progress in the case. Though DNA material had been found with the body of the man, which might lead to the identification of the killer, the investigation was lacking, the reporter had written. That was the trouble these days. People watched too much TV. Everyone was forensic savvy thanks to shows like CSI and Silent Witness, even the criminals. The thought of it all gave Mary a quiet thrill. On the next page was a grainy photograph of the missing woman, Stella Baxter. A picture so old it would be hard to identify anyone from it, but Mary studied it carefully nonetheless. Stella was mousy and nondescript, hardly the face of a callous murderer in Mary's opinion, but then again, it was always the quiet ones you had to watch. A side story caught her attention. Of course. The row between the students. Mary had been told that Amy's father had been tied up with the case in some way. She couldn't believe that such a juicy morsel of scandal had escaped her attention. Just went to show how tired she was. There was a small picture of the house where the bodies had been found. The paper was calling it the House of Horror. Too right. If walls had ears, that place would be screaming out loud. Some places just attracted misery and devastation. She should know. She had started her nurse training in one of the old asylums. 700 beds, all full of mad, sad, and bad people, shut away in a red-brick Victorian monstrosity. There had been a motto carved in stone over the main door. She couldn't remember exactly what it had said now, but in her memory it was always, "Abandon hope, all ye who enter here." It gave her a shudder to think of it now, that building, all those corridors and dark corners, all those rooms that had soaked up the torment of their inhabitants over the years. There was no doubt in her mind that buildings had an influence on people. And that place, the Limes, had a particularly malevolent one. She had to feel sorry for Amy, though. Couldn't it be nice finding out your own father was a killer? No wonder the kid had chosen psychiatry as a career. She was probably desperate to stay on the right side of the sanity fence. She glanced at the clock. Nearly time for the day shift to arrive. Reluctantly, she eased on her shoes, ready to make her final round of the night. Chapter 12. Amy's train had been stuck for hours. So long, in fact, that the other passengers gave a small cheer when it finally started moving again. She had overheard that some idiot had driven a van off the motorway and had rolled it down a bank onto the railway line. The driver was dead, so it had taken a ridiculous amount of time to clear the line. Amy barely registered the awful news about the van and its driver. She was so numb. All she wanted to do was get to London and sort her own mess out. She didn't even bother to look out of the window as the train pulled slowly past the charred and battered mess of the white builder's van. By the time the train reached Paddington, she was starving and knackered. So much so, she didn't know which to deal with first. Something about the crashed van was niggling at her conscience. She had been so absorbed in her own dilemma, she hadn't considered that someone had lost their life that night. In the cold morning light, that fact injected some perspective into her own situation, and she found herself alone in the huge station, feeling more than a little foolish and like a nasty, selfish bitch for not considering what had happened to the van driver. This wasn't the person she wanted to be. Then again, she hadn't thought she was living a lie, hadn't considered that the people who were supposed to care about her most had hidden something so earth-shattering from her. Perhaps this was what secrets and lies did, they made you mean. Well, she was there now. She might as well go and get some answers. Mike Ratcliffe got to the office early that day. Stella's picture had been published in the late edition of yesterday's papers and was all over the morning news. Today he was going to get a result. He was sure of it. Ferris had come through with more forensic evidence. Strands of hair had been found clutched in Roy Baxter's desiccated hand, still in good enough condition for them to get some decent DNA from it. Once Stella had been located, all he needed to do was tie up a few loose ends and close the case. Sorted, he thought with satisfaction. Frances Haynes had regained consciousness too, but was still not fit for interview. She remained in hospital, heavily sedated until the swelling around her brain subsided. Ratcliffe had to pity her, really. Nutcase family and a cold fish husband. Not a lot there to motivate her to pull through. Still, he fervently hoped she would. She was his only hope of finally making some sense out of this odd, odd case. He still needed to find out about the baby, Daniel. Even though it didn't appear that the child had been murdered, someone had concealed the body and someone needed to answer for it. Pondering this issue, he rifled through the papers on his desk. DC Angie Watson had come up with some interesting stuff on the Porter clan. On seeing the copy of Charlie and Rachel's marriage certificate, Ratcliffe thought that perhaps there was some nobility in Charlie Jones after all. Must be if he'd made an honest woman of Rachel. He'd married her when she was pregnant with their kid. The whole thing must have stuck badly in her family's throat, though. The youngest daughter marrying a convicted murderer, having his child. He had never quite believed Rachel's story of a row over money, so the undesirable marriage and the pregnancy gave him a much better idea of why she had been rejected by her family. Strange that she would come back after the mother's death, though. Still, the prospect of an inheritance brought all sorts out of the woodwork. He found himself quite disappointed in her, much to his puzzlement. Angie had also managed to unearth the fact that there was no record of William Porter's death. Not that it had any bearing on the Baxter case. Porter had been long gone by the time Roy Baxter was killed. But if they could find him, he might know something about the dead baby. However, that wasn't a priority, which in a way was a relief. Tracking down people who didn't want to be found was a tedious process at the best of times. He put the documents to one side, a little guilty that he had made Angie trawl through the process of finding them when they had shed so little light on the case. It had kept her busy and out of his hair for the day. Not that he minded working with her, she was a good kid, just a little overzealous sometimes. Still, with Stella's picture out there, he was upbeat and positive. Today would be a good day. He could feel it in his water. Delia was worried sick. Charlie still didn't have his phone switched on. There was no choice. She would just have to go round to the house and find out what the hell was going on. As she trudged the half mile to his house, she grumbled to herself. She was too old for all this. Her legs couldn't take it and her heart couldn't take it either. You spent your whole life worrying about your kids, assuming once they grew up the bother would be over. Not for Delia. With Charlie, the bother just kept getting worse. There was no doubt in her mind that his lack of communication had something to do with Rachel. No doubt at all. Not that Rachel was likely to spill the beans, but Delia couldn't be too careful. Better to be safe than sorry. As she reached the gate, she fumbled in her bag for her key. Charlie's van wasn't on the drive. Typical. He was obviously avoiding her. Well, she would just sit tight until he came back home. Her first thought was that the house had been burgled with all the smashed glass and food down the walls. She had her hand on the phone, ready to dial 999 when she noticed the bracelet, instantly recognizing it as the one Charlie had bought for Rachel when Amy was born. When she looked around the room again, it was clear that nothing was missing, so not burglars. The computer was on. Delia was not au fait with technology, but knew if she clicked the mouse thing, something would happen. It did. The screen flickered into life and showed her Rachel's address in London. Had he lost the plot and gone chasing up there again? Next to the computer, the answer machine was flashing. She pressed the button, expecting to hear the usual work inquiries. As Amy's voice filled the room, she had to press her hand to her mouth as two and two clumped together into a great big four in her mind. Amy had been here. She had come home. It wasn't Charlie who had gone looking for Rachel. It was Amy. "Oh, my God. What am I going to do?" she said, aloud into the empty room. Charlie would kill someone for this. It had been her idea to allow Amy to believe Rachel was dead. The child had asked the question, and it had all been simple at the time. Better than trying to tell her some other lie about why her mother had left. Simpler for Charlie, too. It closed the door. Meant he wouldn't have a good reason for chasing after the impossible anymore. Delia knew better than anyone that any relationship with Rachel was impossible for all their sakes. It was why she had helped her to leave, had taken Amy for her, had kept her wedding ring to prove to Charlie she had gone for good. It was for the best. It was the only way, but this? Amy going up there would ruin everything. Neither of them would ever forgive her. For the first time in more years than she could remember, Delia wanted to cry. Chapter 13. Mary was knackered. All she wanted to do was get through the handover, go home, have a quick bath, and go to bed. So the fact that Laurel was reading her paper while she was talking was really pissing her off. "So," she said loudly, "Bill had a really unsettled night. I gave him Zopaclone PRN, and he's been settled since. Am I boring you, Laurel?" Laurel was frowning. She must have heard Mary speak, but apparently hadn't registered that the words were aimed at her. The sudden silence drew her attention. "Huh?" Everyone was looking at her. Sorry, just something in the paper caught my eye. Sorry, Mary, carry on." "Thank you so much," Mary said, her weary tone loaded with sarcasm. "As I was saying, someone needs to have a word with the doc about Maisie. Get him to change her script, will you? That laxative needs to be given in the morning, not at night. We've got enough to do on nights without having to bath her at 2 a.m. because she's covered in shit. Right, I'm done. I'm going home. You can keep the paper, Laurel, as it's a source of so much fascination to you." Laurel was frowning. "Sorry, it's just this photo. Here, Morrison, do you reckon it looks like that woman who's been visiting Bill?" She threw the paper to her colleague, while Mary impatiently struggled into her coat. "Could be. Difficult to say, this is an old photo, but there is a vague resemblance. To be honest, I haven't paid too much attention to her." The others crowded round him, peering over his shoulder at the picture of Stella. The consensus was that Stella Baxter, wanted for questioning over her husband's murder, was Bill Smith's mystery visitor. Mary took her coat off. Knackered or not, she wasn't going home until this little drama had been resolved. "I'll call the head of nursing, hand it over to him, and you lot, not a word about this to anyone till we know what we've got to do." Something was nudging at the edges of Charlie's consciousness, hauling him up from under the thick blanket of sleep he was so warmly wrapped in. He opened one eye, wincing against the sharp intrusion of light and shielding himself from it with his hand. Someone was banging on the window. Everything in him revolted against the requirement to move, but he needed the banging to stop. Fumbling, he wound down the window and squinted out. "Bloody hell, mate, I was beginning to think you died in your sleep. You okay?" the stranger said, sounding far livelier than anyone had a right to at that time of the morning. Charlie squeezed his eyes shut, as if the action would make it easier for him to open them again and face the day. "Sorry to wait you, mate, but you're on my pitch. I need to get the snack bar set up," the man said, giving a vague wave to the patch of lay-by where Charlie had parked.
"Shit, sorry. Give me a minute and I'll shift," Charlie said,
shaking himself awake and trying to ignore the cramping stiffness that was threatening to cripple his movements.
"Any chance of a cup of tea when you get set up?" he called. His mouth felt like the bottom of a budgie's cage.
He fumbled for the keys, then used the side of his hand to clear the condensation from the inside of the windscreen, hoping that his senses would gather themselves into some semblance of reactivity. He was exhausted. Bad sleep was almost worse than no sleep. He had given the trip up as a bad job as soon as the motorway signs had started to say accident ahead. Figuring that the combination of foul mood and tiredness was a good indicator to pull off and take a break, he'd parked up in the nearest lay-by off the motorway and had intended to shut his eyes for half an hour and give himself the chance to catch up and calm down. He hadn't expected that he would still be there in the morning. He must look like hell. Yesterday alone had aged him 10 years. With the salt and pepper stubble that had invaded his face overnight, he must look like an absolute wreck. No wonder he had been mistaken for a corpse. Right then he needed a pee more than anything else, so he shunted the van forward a few yards, got out and made good use of the grass verge. It took 10 minutes to get his tea. A strange, strong orange concoction only available from roadside snack bars, but fundamentally life-giving to a knackered, desperate man.
"Nasty accident last night a few miles up. Van ended up on the railway line, caused a 5-car pile-up on the motorway. I reckon you made a wise move keeping in your van, mate,"
the snack bar man said as he laid out fatty strips of bacon on a greasy, unsavoury-looking griddle.
"Bacon wrap to go with that?"
Charlie shook his head. The man shrugged and threw a handful of cheap sausages into a deep-fat fryer. The sight of it made Charlie's stomach lurch.
"So, what's up then? You in the doghouse with the missus? What did you do to deserve that, then?"
the man quipped. Charlie put his empty mug on the counter.
"Nothing much, just married her in the first place."
The man laughed heartily, pointing a fish slice at Charlie as he bellowed.
"That's a good one, that. I like it."
Charlie smiled and moved away from the van just as a lorry pulled into the lay-by. He needed to get home, have a shower, do some work, and get Rachel out of his head for a few hours. He still wasn't in the best of moods when he finally got there, so the last thing he needed was to see his mother sitting on the sofa with her arms crossed, looking just about ready to explode. Neither was he too chuffed to see half his belongings strewn across the floor, not to mention the remains of God knows what stuck to the wall.
"Where in the hell have you been? I've been worried sick,"
Delia yelled before he'd even had a chance to put his keys down.
"Don't start. I'm a grown man and where I've been is my business,"
he shot back as his eyes took in the scene in front of him.
"What the hell happened here?"
Delia was on her feet now. "You might well ask." He spotted Amy's bag on the floor.
"Oh my God, where's Amy? What happened? Where is she? Is she all right?"
he demanded, adrenaline surging through his system and making his heart cringe with fear.
"How should I know? This whole bloody mess is all your fault!"
Delia cried, hurling Rachel's SOS bracelet at him so that it hit him square in his chest.
"She could be anywhere thanks to you, you stupid sod!"
Charlie bent to pick up the bracelet.
"Where did you get this?"
His voice was a hoarse, tight whisper.
"I found it on your coffee table, and before you ask, I don't know where Amy got it from, but I'm pretty damn sure she worked out who it was and who it belongs to.
Look on the computer, she found out where Rachel lives," Delia said desperately.
"She's been in your box upstairs too, I found this in the garage."
She showed him the ravaged tin, empty of its contents. Realization dawned on Charlie, draining the color from his face and robbing the strength from his legs.
"Fuck, she's gone to look for, hasn't she?"
he said, staggering towards the sofa and collapsing onto it. Glass crunched under his feet. He picked up the shattered picture frame.
"Oh, God, everything was in that tin. Letters, the marriage certificate, Rachel's ring, everything. She knows we lied. Oh, God. Well, he isn't going to be much good to us, is he?"
Delia said, her anger ebbing away like the tide, leaving her looking like the tired old woman she really was. Charlie leapt to his feet and lurched towards the kitchen, where he flung open the cupboard door and saw the false pipe hanging loose.
"What the hell are you doing now?" Delia called.
"She's got 500 quid in cash. She's gone to London," he said, already back in the lounge searching for his keys. "I'm going to get her."
"You think she's going to want to see you after this?"
Delia demanded, waving her hand across the room, framing the chaos for him as if he hadn't noticed the significance of it himself.
"I'm not prepared to give her the choice. Besides, it was you who told her Rachel was dead, not me. I didn't have a choice but to go along with it, did I?"
Delia set her mouth into a grim line.
"It was for the best," she said defensively.
Charlie slammed on the door with his fist.
"What, so she could find out like this? Did you honestly think Rachel would stay away forever, that one day it wouldn't all come out? He yelled, making Delia jump.
Don't you bloody well blame me for this mess. All I did was help make the best of a bad job. Clear up after yet another of your balls-ups. She agreed. The day she left, she agreed Amy should think she was dead. It was the best way, the only way. If it were up to her, she would never have come back, but you had to keep pushing it, going up there, pushing her and pushing her. You're like some filthy dog, having to go back again and again to smell your own shit.
Charlie stared at her, confused.
What did you say?
The day she left.
What about the day she left?
Delia looked away from him. Her temper had got the better of her and she had said too much.
Charlie leapt across the room, grabbing her by the arm, pinching the loose flesh and shaking her.
You saw her, didn't you?
He yelled.
Delia closed her eyes and tried to pull away from him. He dropped her arm and turned away from her, a look of disgust on his face. He clutched at his head as if it were a bomb about to explode.
19 years, Mum. 19 years you've let me believe that she dumped my daughter on your doorstep and walked away. Why would you do that? Why would you let me despise her for something she didn't do? You talked to her, you saw her, and you let her go.
He was shaking his head in anguish. Delia couldn't answer him. Grief and regret were overwhelming her, causing her whole body to tremble. Her world was falling apart and she didn't know what to do to stop it.
I'm sorry. So sorry,
was all she could say.
Tell me what happened, Charlie demanded through gritted teeth.
Delia shook her head, having to hug herself to stop the shaking.
I didn't know what else to do. She came round with Amy and she was in such a state, she was in bits. She told me to tell you she'd abandoned her. She knew you would never let her go if you didn't have a reason to hate her.
Damn right I wouldn't have let her go. She and Amy were everything to me, my whole world. We would have been okay, we would have coped. Once I got her away from that damn family, she wouldn't have had the fits anyway, you know that. She was always all right when she was away from them. I know she was scared, but we would have been okay. So what was it, Mum? Did she come to you for help? Did you talk her out of staying, so damn glad to see the back of her that you persuaded her to go? Tell me how it was. Tell me what you thought was better about letting her go and destroying our lives, he spat. She had never seen him so angry.
Delia was in bits herself now. Everything she had tried so hard to hold together was slipping away. Amy had run away and her son could do nothing but look at her with hate in his eyes. All she had ever done was do her best to protect him, protect all of them. That day there had been no choice. To tell him the truth would have destroyed him completely. What she had done had been the lesser evil, the choice with the least collateral damage attached. He needed to know that. He needed to hear the facts, and then he would know that she had never done anything other than shelter him and Amy. She took a breath.
All right. I'll tell you how it was, but you're not going to like what you hear, so we'd better both sit down and pull ourselves together.
Charlie dropped heavily into a chair and stared at her, waiting, his jaw twitching with rage. Delia lowered herself wearily onto the sofa.
Yes, you can look at me like that and blame me for everything that's gone wrong for you. Why change the habit of a lifetime? Always someone else, isn't it? Everyone always out to get you, aren't they? Well, son, did it ever occur to you that this whole vile mess all comes back to you?
She looked at the expression on his face.
Yes, Charlie Jones, you. And believe me, it is a vile mess, too.
She paused.
As for Rachel, I loved that girl like she was my own. I would never have hurt her, not in a million years. But you hurt her deeper than anyone ever could have, and you didn't even know it because you were so wrapped up in yourself. If anyone has a right to be bitter and hard, it's that poor girl, and she was the one left alone to shoulder the lot, while you screwed your life up feeling sorry for yourself.
She shook her head in a gesture of weary resignation. Charlie sighed.
Are you ever going to get to the point, or would you just like to carry on digging at me?
Delia rounded on him.
Shut up, you arrogant sod. You have no idea what you're asking me to tell you here, so shut up and have the decency to hear me out, or by God, I will slap that look off your face once and for all.
I'm 77 years of age and about to tell you about the hardest thing I've ever had to do in my life, so show me some damn respect, you little shit. You might be the big man in your own mind, Charlie Jones, but you're still a kid in mine.
She took a breath and crossed her arms.
That day Rachel had gone back to the house.
To tell them that you and her were married, that Amy was yours, and that she was leaving for good. You knew that. You were the one who wanted her to do it. Stand up to them, remember? Yes? So don't sit there looking all innocent. Anyway, I got a visitor that day. Her ladyship herself deigned to call, and she had something very interesting to say. Oh, yes. Valerie came round. Got your attention now, have I? Good. She took another deep breath, her face creasing in distaste as she went on. She had a tale to tell, all right, quite a tale. You see, Charlie boy, it turns out that she isn't Rachel's mother after all. Frances is. Yes, Frances. Your little playmate way back then. Pregnant at 14. Of course, Valerie couldn't face the shame of it, so she took Frances away and came back telling the world that the baby was hers. Remember that? Yeah, thought you might. No one was any the wiser, were they? Charlie looked bemused.
Yeah, a bit of a shocker, admittedly, but what does it have to do with Rachel leaving? He asked with a shrug. Makes no difference to me who her mother is. The fact that it's not Valerie is a bonus in my mind.
Delia shook her head from side to side several times.
See, there he goes with the arrogance again, she said, looking heavenward. So how do you think she reacted when she found out who her father was, eh?
What the hell are you on about, Mum? Get to the point, will you? He said, his tone laden with exasperation.
Delia stood up. She didn't want to be sitting down when she said the next words.
Put it this way. How do you think Rachel felt when she heard that she and Amy have the same father?
Nothing happened for a minute or so. No sound intruded save the ticking of the clock. Nothing stirred except the shifting look of horror that crossed Charlie's face again and again. His stomach erupted, sending a torrent of thick, yellow bile up into his throat until he had no choice but to spew it out onto the carpet, until he was empty and there was nothing but spasms of pain in his gut.
I'm sorry, son. I never wanted to tell you, but you gave me no choice. Perhaps now you'll understand why she left, Delia said eventually.
Charlie, head hanging over the side of the chair and gulping in air to stop the retching, turned to her.
I was a 14-year-old kid, Mum, he gasped. I know. Doesn't make it any less the truth, she said sadly, a look of extrinsic shame on her face.
Charlie gripped the arms of the chair, anchoring himself to its structure because it felt so much more solid to him than his own body did.
Truth.
Truth. I can't remember the last time I heard a word of that from anyone's mouth. Are you telling me you actually believe what that poisonous old bitch told you? That I had got Frances pregnant?
He felt feverish. He felt weak. The implications of what he had just heard were bombarding his brain like a swarm of angry hornets. Sweat beaded his forehead, and a sense of panic was wrapping itself around him like a straitjacket. Delia didn't speak.
Like I said, I was a kid.
14. He was running it through his head, the past, going over it again and again, just to make sure he had it right. Could he have forgotten something like that? Could a man forget his first sexual experience? No. Without a doubt, no.
It never happened.
She was lying. If you want to know the truth, Patsy was the first, and I didn't meet her until I was 17.
Christ, at 14, he had barely discovered that you could do anything else but piss through it. Delia just stood there, blinking like a dumb animal caught in the beam of a torch. He started to laugh in a dull, almost baying howl.
It's ironic, isn't it? You never believed I was capable of murder. You stood by me through all of that. But ask if a man is capable of keeping it in his pants and you don't believe a word of it. Thanks, Mother. Thanks a lot.
No one would lie about that.
Surely, Delia said, seemingly not even to him, but to the ether, as if it could give her a more convincing answer.
They lied about murder, why not that?
Charlie reasoned, still bitter. Then he roared in frustration.
How many years of my life does that family want? How many pounds of my flesh?
Delia started to shudder again. She looked defeated, and he could see every one of her years hanging off her bones like lead weights. In that moment, he could feel nothing but disgust for her. He stood up, watching her flinch away from him as he moved across the room.
I'm going for a shower. I need to think. When I come out, I want you gone.
What are you going to do?
She whispered, her voice trembling.
Go and find my daughter and my wife and fix this mess.
Chapter 14. Of all the calls from people claiming they had seen Stella Baxter, Only one warranted a follow-up in Mike Ratcliffe's opinion. Putting anything in the papers always brought the cranks and the hoaxers out of the woodwork, but a phone call from the NHS didn't fit that category. There was a chance he might have caught two birds with one stone. He had a reasonable suspicion that he had tracked down William Porter, too, only he was known as Bill Smith now. Which was odd, as Ratcliffe remembered Bill as a sozzled old tramp who'd been just one of the banes of his life when he'd been in uniform. The old vagrant hadn't crossed his mind in years, yet Ratcliffe could picture him now as clearly as if he'd seen him yesterday. Ferris had completed her work up on Roy Baxter, and was currently awaiting the DNA results on the hair that was found on his body. With a bit of luck, they'd be able to close the file soon, and he could get D.I. Benton off his back and take a bit of time off. A fishing trip, alone and away from home, might be a good idea. A beatific smile came to his lips at the thought. "Looking smug, boss? What's making you so happy?" Angie asked, placing a mug of tea down in front of him. Ratcliffe grinned at her. "Nothing more gratifying than a plan coming together, Ange. We all sorted for this afternoon?" "All ready to go. Apparently our woman always visits at 2 o'clock. We'll be in place well before then. We need to set off from here by 10, at the latest." Ratcliffe leaned forward and rubbed his hands together in fervent anticipation. "Bring it on, DC Watson, bring it on." "I contacted Roy Baxter's sister about the body being released for burial," Angie said, perching on the edge of his desk and then standing again quickly when he raised his eyebrows at her. "And?" "Didn't want to know. In fact, her exact words were, 'You can shove him in a bin bag and stick him on the local tip for all I care.'" "Nice woman," she added with a wry grin. "I think we can safely say that he was not a popular man then. Better contact the relevant authorities and get them to sort it." "What about the baby? Doesn't seem like anyone wants to sort that out either." "Same goes," Ratcliffe said with a resigned shrug. Angie nodded, though putting an innocent child into an unmarked mass grave didn't seem right to either of them, judging by the look on her face. The director of nursing didn't want either his staff or his patients involved in the arrest of the suspect. He insisted that whatever intervention the police were planning, it must take place outside the unit. Given that the unit couldn't be accessed without a key code, it wasn't likely that they would miss Stella, if she was Stella, when she arrived. The plan was to intercept her calmly as she made her way to the building. Two officers would be inside the building just in case, and uniformed units were stationed discreetly at all exit points. As they were dealing with a small, nondescript, middle-aged woman, Ratcliffe didn't anticipate too many problems. After all, she was hardly likely to pull a gun on them and start shooting, but it was best to be prepared because you never knew what was going to pan out. It always paid to be one step ahead of the game. The staff on the unit informed him that her habit was to arrive at around 2 o'clock. She always signed herself in as Barbara Smith, never engaged in conversation with the staff, and left promptly an hour later. The biggest risk of the day was that she would have seen the media coverage and would know that she was likely to have been recognized by someone. Ergo, she wouldn't turn up, and Ratcliffe would have to justify some expensive policing to the powers that be. But the unit staff had said she looked very similar to the photograph, just older. So it didn't seem that she had gone to any great lengths to disguise herself. Having arrived early, they had attempted to interview Bill Smith, but had been unable to get any sense out of him at all. He hadn't even remembered that he'd had a visitor, let alone who she was. Peter Haynes had told them that William Porter died in 1970, leaving his family practically destitute, having lost the family money through bad management and ill temper. Their only means of support was the income from the haberdashery shop run by Stella. It had been closed down when Valerie Porter had suffered a stroke and needed Stella to care for her. Peter had urged them to sell the house and put Valerie into a nursing home, but Stella had refused to budge on the issue. Even Francis had been surprisingly reluctant, according to Peter, who'd explained that his wife hadn't been close to her mother. Of course, it was now apparent that if Bill Smith were, in fact, William Porter, then the house couldn't have been legitimately sold, notwithstanding the fact that someone had concealed dead bodies on the premises. Given that information, Ratcliffe felt he could safely conclude that Stella knew her father was still alive. Had she bolted from the house after Valerie's death because she knew the game was finally up? Sitting there in the car park, waiting for his first glimpse of her, Ratcliffe was impatient for answers. "Do you know what I don't get?" Angie said as they scanned the area. "How come no one ever questioned that Baxter or Porter had disappeared?" Ratcliffe thought it was a fair point, and something he had been giving a good deal of thought to. "Well, the way I see it is that someone would have to give a shit about you to notice you were gone. As we've established, there are no friends, no relatives who give a damn, no work colleagues, not even a bloody milkman. Hence no one to notice and no one to make a report.
Porter was a recluse, and Baxter was a bastard, so it was good riddance to Baxter. And Porter? Porter who? No one missed him, except Stella. He knew Angie had to agree. She had done most of the interviews with the neighbours, and had the misfortune of meeting Baxter's sister, Maureen. None of the neighbours could remember William Porter, as all of them had moved in after 1970. Besides, not many of those big detached houses were private homes anymore. Not many people could afford them. The house next door had been a dentist surgery for the past 30 years. The house opposite had been converted into bedsits in the 1980s, and had an ever-shifting population, most of whom were too busy trying to avoid the landlord to be paying any attention to anyone else. Another was a bail hostel, one a residential home for the elderly, another owned by an elderly woman who had fallen foul of Valerie Porter somewhere back in the annals of history, and as a result had stoically ignored her existence ever since. Nobody knew, and nobody cared. Even the family GP had to get the medical notes out of long-term storage, and couldn't recall ever having seen any of them. His predecessor was the one who had treated Rachel's epilepsy, and there was no mention of any maternity care for any of them. Stella had done all the shopping, banking, and paying of bills, and she had been so faceless that people had struggled to place her at all. As for Roy Baxter's family, they had a good riddance to bad rubbish attitude. He had left home at 16 and hadn't kept contact since. The few people Angie had managed to track down and talk with who had known him as an adult had all repeated the same story. That he had left his mousy little wife for pastors new, and no news was good news. One or two people still claimed he owed them money, so they had figured this no-show was par for the course. In any case, he had never been a popular man. Angie had said that she found it hard to believe that people could live like that, almost completely devoid of contact with others. The only ones who appeared remotely normal were Francis and Peter. They had successfully distanced themselves from the rest of the family right up until Valerie's death. From what Ratcliffe could surmise, they'd only got involved then because Haynes had thought the house would be worth money. But he was being solidly unhelpful since he'd found out that William Porter might still be alive. Ratcliffe was sure that Rachel knew more than she was letting on too. It was a bit too convenient that she sparked out every time the questions got tough. The radio crackled into life, breaking into his thoughts. One of the other units had spotted Stella Baxter. "Come on, kid, we're on," he said to Angie, as he launched himself out of the car ready to intercept Bill Smith's mystery visitor. Chapter 15. By rights, Charlie shouldn't have been driving. He was knackered and probably more distracted than he would have been if he'd downed a bottle of scotch before getting in the van. Sick of trying to work out how he felt, he had mentally extracted himself from the emotional melee and was busy trying to work out how many bricks he would need to build a one extension on the back of a 3-bed semi. Anything to rein in his thoughts. He would have recited his 12-times table out loud if he thought it might help. Memory was playing tricks on him. He knew that he had never touched Francis, yet now it had been suggested to him. The vision of it kept nudging at him, insistently inviting him to give it credence. Could he have? Did he? Had he blocked it out? No one would lie about such a thing. They had to think it for a reason. Unable to accept that anyone could indict him like that, his mind could only make sense of it by trying to make it real. But it wasn't. He knew it for a fact. Patsy had been the first and an event in his life that he would always remember. So indelibly was the humiliation of it carved on his psyche. Oh, sure, she'd been sympathetic when he'd only managed to last 2 minutes, but he would never forget the sly smile that had gone with it, or the sigh of tolerance when she had told him it was okay. No, his mind could play as many tricks as it liked. He had never touched Francis Porter. Not that she hadn't wanted him to. In fact, he distinctly recalled her calling him a filthy cretin when he turned her down. She had treated him with the utmost contempt ever since. She and Valerie were bloody twin souls. To the best of his knowledge, the only child he had ever fathered was Amy. Although the marriage to Patsy had only come about because she'd claimed to be pregnant, no wonder his mother had been so ready to believe the Porters. Patsy's baby had never materialized. She had claimed a miscarriage. He'd pitied her at the time, married for only a month and losing their baby. Hindsight had often made him question whether there ever had been a baby at all, or whether she'd just wanted a ring on her finger as an excuse to leave home. Her mother had died years before, and Patsy hated being her father's skivvy and having to be nice to his frequent, ever-changing girlfriends. Maybe she'd just wanted a home and a family of her own, just not with him, it seemed. He had known when Patsy died that she was going to leave him. That knowledge had been one of the things that had sealed his fate that day, that and being stupid enough to pull the knife out of her. The papers had called it a crime of passion, but he'd be hard-pressed to remember any passion in their relationship.
From the minute they got married, she treated him like an inconvenient stray dog. Her affair with Roy Baxter had probably started at the wedding reception, but Roy had been his boss, and back then, Charlie hadn't had the balls to challenge it. In fact, he'd been relieved when she told him she was leaving. Patsy had let him off the hook. Marrying her had been a huge mistake, and he'd known it before the cake had been cut. Not that anyone had wanted to believe that. Being found next to her body with a knife in his hand had obscured any objective views. Patsy had been beautiful, and he'd been in awe of her. He'd mistaken it for love, but not for long. Not everything that glitters is gold, and Patsy had been pure brass. There was only one woman he genuinely loved, and he had brought her nothing but misery. He didn't even want to imagine what it must have been like for her all these years, having to believe that disgusting lie. Even thinking about it made him want to rage and roar and break the world. It must have been like 10 kinds of hell for Rachel. She would have blamed herself, sucked up the responsibility of it and worn it like a hair shirt. The whole woebegone Miss Havisham setup in the flat began to make sense. It was her idea of penance. Change nothing, affect nothing. He had spent all these years feeling so sorry for himself, he'd forgotten to wonder what it might have been like for her. Why had she believed them? Why had she listened to a word Valerie said? A memory of her sprang into his mind. She'd had her back to him, her flesh bare, the light from the bedside lamp washing over her skin, highlighting the scars left by Valerie's weapon of choice, a thin leather belt. Of course Rachel had believed it. She would have been too afraid not to. The only time in his life he had ever felt capable of cold-blooded murder was the day he had first set eyes on those marks. If Valerie had been standing in front of him at that moment, he could swear now that he'd have ripped her heart out with his bare hands and spat in the hole he'd left. He had not long been out of prison, a few weeks at most, paroled to his mother's house. On the walk from his weekly visit to the probation office, it had started to rain so heavily that he'd had to shelter in an alley. As he'd waited for the downpour to ease, he'd spotted Rachel, running up the road with her boyfriend in tow. He hadn't taken to the boyfriend, had him down as an obnoxious little shit the first time he clapped eyes on him. The kid had been yelling at Rachel to hurry up, dragging her along the road, yanking at her arm. She'd stumbled, gone down on her knees, and the arsehole had lost the plot with her. Hauling her to her feet, the little shit had screamed obscenities into her face and had shaken her like a rag doll. She had started to seize. Charlie saw her head go back and her body stiffen as the guy dropped her right into the gutter. He'd wanted to move then, instinct taking over. It wasn't the first time Charlie had had to deal with her having a fit. When she'd been a little kid, he had often been the one who had had to see her through it. If Stella wasn't around, no one else had cared. The boyfriend didn't. He'd looked around, checking to see that no one was watching before he'd kicked her in the ribs. Something primal had risen inside Charlie's head. 10 years in prison, and an ingrained abhorrence of injustice took over and propelled him across the street, balled his hand into a fist, and sent it smashing into that pompous, evil, spotty, arrogant little face. The kid had gone down like a sack of shit, and Charlie had warned him with his fist an inch from his busted nose that if he ever went near Rachel again, he, Charlie Jones, the convicted killer, would personally rip his head off and crap down the hole. The kid had threatened him with the police. Charlie had said, "Bring it on, kid. I've already done one stretch for murder, another won't make much difference." If it hadn't been so wet from the rain, he could have sworn that the kid had pissed himself. All those long, boring days inside with not much else to do other than fool around in the prison gym had made him twice the man he had been in every sense. The kid had been scared witless and had scurried away like the rat he was. Rachel had been a mess. She had cracked her head on the curb when she fell and was covered in muck and God knows what else from the wet gutter. She was fuzzy after the fit, and he'd had to pretty much carry her back to his mum's house. Delia had been out at the time, so he'd had no choice but to try to sort her out himself. He probably should have taken her to A&E, but reality had kicked in and he'd started to feel panicky about hitting the kid and the prospect of being arrested again. Rachel had been in shock, teeth chattering, unable to speak, unable to look at him properly. He'd run her a bath. She'd been filthy and freezing, her clothes soaked. She'd sat in that bath for an age. Probably would have stayed in there if he hadn't knocked on the door, bringing a towel and some dry clothes. He'd given her an old T-shirt and a pair of jogging trousers of his own. The only alternative had been one of Delia's frilly dressing gowns. It hadn't been an occasion for frills. When she'd come out of the bathroom, he'd asked her to show him where the kid had kicked her. She was moving awkwardly, and he reckoned she had a busted rib. She'd sat on the edge of his bed and lifted up the top. Purple spots of bruising had already started to pepper her skin. He'd told her they should strap her ribs, so he'd dosed her with paracetamol and ripped up an old sheet for long bandages. He'd had to strap his own ribs a few times over the years, so he knew what he was doing. She couldn't hold the T-shirt up, it hurt too much. So he'd helped her to ease it off, looking away as she blushed and tried to cover her breasts. He'd told her to turn around and lift